Bible says, flee immorality. Don't hesitate, don't analyze, just get away. But what about immoral people, rejecters of Christ? Are you supposed to avoid them at all costs? Can you be too eager to separate? We'll consider that next on Grace to You. Said that no man is an island. Well, it's true. We all interact with others. Some relationships are very strong. Some are more casual. Point is, you're relating to people all the time, whether it be family, co-workers, fellow students, the gal you see in the elevator each day, the guy that you get the morning coffee from. What about those personal connections, especially with unbelievers? Are there hazards? Can you reach a point where your Christian influence stops and the unbelievers takes over? Learn all that you can about the pitfalls to avoid. Make sure that your relationships are all they should be, all that God desires from you. Follow along now as Bible teacher John MacArthur brings today's grace to you. He is mapping out what he calls the relationship danger zone.
I want to give you a bit of historical perspective and take you back behind the Corinthian text to let you know that God has always called his people to separate themselves completely from all forms of false religion. For the sake of their faithfulness, for the sake of their purity, for the sake of their usefulness, for the sake of their blessing, for the sake of God's own glory, for the sake of His name, for the sake of His truth, God has always called His people to separate themselves from false religion. False religion, of course, wrecks the faith of many. It eats destructively like spiritual gangrene. It has always had that effect, and so God has always called his people to separation. Satan always disguises himself as an angel of light, concocts religions which attempt to overthrow the purposes of God and confuse the people of God. That is always his ploy, past, present, and future. And so God has always addressed the issue of his people staying away from satanic religion. Let's go back into the Pentateuch and see how it all kind of got started when God was first identifying his people Israel. If you go back to the book of Deuteronomy, the fifth of the books of Moses that make up the law or the Pentateuch, and turn to chapter 7, we get a very good insight into this matter of separation from false religion. In Deuteronomy chapter 7, we read this. When the Lord your God, verse 1, shall bring you into the land where you are entering to possess it, that is, into the land of Canaan, the land of Israel, and shall clear away many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you. When you go into the land and the Lord clears the way for you by defeating these peoples who are greater and stronger than you. Verse 2, and when the Lord your God shall deliver them before you, and you shall defeat them, then you shall utterly destroy them. Now that's a very, very direct command to kill them. He's calling, in a word, for a form of genocide. Wipe them out. Blot them out. Exterminate them. It is just such a strong command that makes liberal theologians quiver and conclude that obviously this is not a true representation of God, because God is love and God would never make such an order, let alone carry it out. How are we to understand that God says exterminate these nations? Well, the command can only be reconciled with the patient and gracious and loving character of God, all of which are true about him, if you understand some things. If you understand, for example, the enormous wickedness of these people. If you understand the enormity of their idolatry. If you understand the severity of their blasphemy of God. If you understand that that is an idolatry so gross and so deadly and so incorrigible and so hopeless and so without repentance that it has the potential to devastatingly affect God's purposes, then you can understand why God called for their extermination. The New Testament says evil company corrupts good morals. Having the children of God live side by side with these blasphemous, incorrigible, wicked, unrepentant idolaters whose crimes had reached to his nostrils day after day could only end in the corruption of God's people. God could not preserve his people if they entered associations with such idolatrous nations. And God knew that they had reached past the point of grace. Repentance was past, not on the horizon. They were fixed in their impenitence. They were resolute. They were therefore hopeless. And God was not going to allow the cancer of their blasphemy to totally debilitate his own eternal purposes. And so he called for their destruction. Following that up in verse 2, he elucidates, "You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them." No alliances and no compromises. You deal drastically, dramatically, and finally with them. Verse 3, "Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons." Does it mean when it says, "Do not be bound together with unbelievers, do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers," that Christians shouldn't marry non-Christians? Well, certainly that is true. Christians should not marry non-Christians. That is being unequally yoked, because marriage is a spiritual relationship. But if you are looking for something more specific, here it is. Here is a prohibition against the people of God intermarrying with people who are not his people. Why? Verse 4, "Any covenant, any alliance, any compromise, any intermarriage will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods." Just as we saw with no less a strong and wise and blessed man than Solomon. "They will turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods, and then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you." There is a lot at stake here. You cannot afford a compromise. You must exterminate those people, or they will devastatingly influence you. You cannot commingle with them. It can't be done without tragic results. Verse 5, "But thus you shall do to them. You shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and hew down their asherim." That's places and pieces of their worship. "And burn their graven images with fire." Interesting. Remove their temples, smash them to the ground, cut down their altars, destroy anything and everything that has been any part of the abominable religion they practiced. You must do that. It's like getting rid of a deadly virus. You have to kill it at every location. You have to wipe out every vestige of it because the risk of spiritual contamination is so high. This passage, by the way, became a mandate for the Scottish reformers. I've been reading a lot lately about John Knox. We think of John Knox, of course, as the great preacher who really was the driving force in the founding of Scottish Presbyterianism. And to this day, when you preach in Scotland, the pulpit in the Church of Scotland is called the John Knox pulpit. We think of John Knox as a great reformer, a great preacher of the gospel. Now, he was a very aggressive man, almost a warring man. John Knox assaulted false religion with a vengeance. In fact, the Scottish reformers went after all the edifices, all of the buildings that remained of the terrible Romish cult, and they smashed them all, much to the dismay of the lovers of architecture. who were trying to preserve the architectural images. But the maxim of John Knox was right. John Knox said, pull down the nests and the birds will disappear. Well, here you have a very similar situation. This particular people of God, the nation Israel, into the land of God, are given this direct mandate from God. I hasten to add, I don't think we can go around smashing the buildings of false religions without such a divine mandate. And as well-intentioned as the Scottish reformers may have been, they might have overstepped their bounds. But certainly there's no question about it here in Deuteronomy, and there's no question about the intent of the Scottish reformers to preserve the influence, to preserve their people from the influence of false religion. It's all around us. And we need to come and be separate from it. God gives the reason in verse 6. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The word holy means separate, sanctified, set apart. You are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. You are separate from them. He called you out. You are his own possession. You belong to no other person and no other deity. And so, very early in God's redemptive revelation, it becomes abundantly clear that the people of God are to make sure they have no alliances and no covenants and no interchange with false religion. Taking it from a collective perspective there in Deuteronomy 7 to a personal one, turn to Daniel chapter 1. And here we look not at a group of people so much as individuals. And we meet four young men, familiar to us and to anyone who knows the stories of the Bible, are Daniel and his three friends, Mishael, Hananiah, and Azariah, that being their Jewish names. We find here a very similar situation. Daniel 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. So here comes Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, to Jerusalem, besieges it, wins the victory. And some of the vessels of the house of God he takes, brought them to the land of Shinar, the land of Babylon, to the house of his God, and brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. So they plundered the temple full of all kinds of gold and hauled it all back to Babylon and put it in the temple of his own deity. He didn't have any trouble mingling deities. He didn't have any trouble mingling worship. As we noted in our studies earlier on this same subject, God has a lot of trouble with that. You don't take an idol into the temple of God, and you don't take God into an idol temple. As we saw in the case of 1 Samuel 4 through 6 and the case of Ezekiel chapter 8, but obviously, Nebuchadnezzar didn't have a problem with that. He had many gods, and throwing more vessels from another deity into the temple wouldn't make a difference. So there is the plundering of Jerusalem. In this particular situation, there was an initial deportation. That is, they took people captive, Jewish people captive, back to the land of Babylon. They wanted to maintain the land of Israel as a vassal state. They wanted Israel to be productive economically. And so they wanted to leave some people there who could continue to function in the land so that it could increase the wealth and prosperity of Babylon working in their behalf. The first deportation is described in verses 3 and 4. The king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel. That's the first deportation, 606 or so, including B.C., including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding, discerning knowledge, who had the ability for serving in the king's court, and he ordered him, that is Ashpenaz, to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. Now, here was basically the plan of Nebuchadnezzar. He attacked Jerusalem. Problem was, his first shot, 606, he got word that Nabopolassar, his father, had died. And so right at the very beginning of his campaign, he had to go back to Babylon because of the death of his father. Treks like that were not easy, and it was a major move. When he went back, he had to change his plan. Not having time to set up his own government there, he decided to leave the Jewish king Jehoiakim in power, but basically to strip him of everybody around him and of any hope for future power. And so he took some of the royal family and some of the nobles. No doubt they were hostages. He probably threatened Jehoiakim if he didn't do what he wanted him to do, he'd kill his own family and his own nobles. And he had taken the best of them, described in verse 4, the best looking, the smartest, the most wise, the most discerning, who had the kind of ability that could be used in the highest levels of government in that land. He didn't have time, as I said, to set up his own operation in Judah, so he wanted leverage against the king so that the king would do what he wanted him to do. But he also had another plan in mind. He took the elite leaders of the nation, all the young men who were gifted and capable, and he took them in order that he might brainwash them in Chaldean culture, because he needed somebody to administer Jewish affairs. Now he's got a pile of Jewish people being deported out of Israel into his own land. There's three deportations going to take place. The last one in 586 BC. Three major deportation of Jewish people. These Jewish people could constitute a reactionary, revolutionary, terrorist group in the middle of Babylon if they weren't controlled. And so the idea was get the best young men, train the best young men, and use them to administer Jewish affairs. They will understand the Jews, they'll understand how they think and how they operate, but they will buy into the Chaldean culture. So the brainwashing process was what he was after, and he wanted to brainwash the very best. Then when the time came, they could remove Jehoiakim, send somebody back who was a Jew but had been brainwashed effectively in Chaldean culture, as well as having young men to administer affairs right there in Babylon over the Jewish people. He wanted only the best, only those who were the cream of the crop. And indeed, they picked those very young men. Now, you will notice at the end of verse 4 that the idea was to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. What that boils down to is theology, because the literature of the Chaldeans was theology. You cannot separate their culture from their religion. Their religion was their culture. Their culture was simply made up of magic, sorcery, enchantments, omens, prayers, hymns to their deities, a multiplicity of deities, all kinds of legends about the deities, a very complex theology, utterly alien to the truth and alien to the true God. They wanted these youths, believe me, to forget Jehovah, to forget the true and living God, and to worship the Babylonian trinity of Anu, Elil, and Ea. And so they began to teach them theology. This was a 3-year training program, as you will note a little later in the chapter, a 3-year reprogramming, a 3-year brainwashing process. Further, verse 5, they wanted to alter not only their theology, but as a part of this brainwashing, to alter their lifestyle and suck them right into pagan worship. The king appointed to them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now remember, these young men are from the royal family, and they are the nobles of Israel. So fancy food wasn't anything new. They had probably been living in and around the palace in Jerusalem, which was extremely prosperous. Now remember, before the destruction of this temple, it was the Solomonic temple, and it was a somewhat wealthy nation and a prosperous nation. Those indications are given even in the prophecies of Isaiah and Jeremiah, who prophesied the captivity to come, but there are still notes about the wealth and prosperity of the nation. So these young men weren't particularly enamored, surely, with having good food and good wine that would have been available to them in the past. The issue here is that they would be literally engaging in idol feasts, because as we found with the Corinthians, the food and drink at the idol feasts was part of the celebration of their religious services. And so this food which came from the king would be food dedicated to the deities. The king's choice food and wine would be a part of some feast to the deities, and they would literally be engaged in eating that in that kind of context. Not that there was anything wrong with the food because of that, but they would be indulging themselves, to put it in Paul's terms, in the tables of demons. So verse 8 says, Daniel sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Daniel knew that he couldn't allow himself to get sucked in to this pagan lifestyle, this religious lifestyle. Well, there was more. Go back to verse 6. They did another very wise thing. They tried to change the people's identity, change their theology, change their form of worship, and change their identity. There were four young men, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The commander of the officials assigned new names to them. To Daniel, which means God is judge, magnificent name, God is judge, he assigned the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, which means the Lord is gracious in Hebrew, he gave the name of Shadrach, associated with the term Aku or Marduk, one of the idols of Babylon. To Mishael, a beautiful name, it really is a question. It means, who is like the Lord? Or literally, who is what the Lord is? They give him the name Meshach, which means, who is what Aku is? And Aku was the moon god. And to Azariah, which means, the Lord is my help, they gave the name Abednego, servant of Nebo, who was the god of wisdom and education. So the brainwashing was pretty comprehensive. Change their theology, change their lifestyle, get them involved in idol festivals, change their names so that every time you speak to them, every time they have to identify themselves, they identify themselves with our gods, and we will wean them away from the true God. Verse 8, but Daniel made up his mind. He would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. He still was granted by God in verse 9 favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. But he would not defile himself. Not to defile himself. The word defile comes from ga'al in Hebrew. It means to stain or pollute. He wanted to do everything to avoid this compromise, everything to disconnect himself from false religious activity. He would worship only the true God. And the one thing that stood out was the food, because it constituted the engagement of an idol feast. And he would not do it, and neither would his friends. And God honored them, and when the time of the 3 years passed, they were in better health and better intellect than everybody else. God blessed them for their non-compromising spirit, spirit of preserving the truth. Eventually, it got costly, and Daniel ended up in a lion's den, and Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael ended up in a fiery furnace. Satan will always try to pollute the true religion by sucking God's people into unholy alliances with false religion. We must completely separate from all forms of false religion.
With that, John MacArthur ends today's installment from a study that's answering the question, when and why should you separate from unbelievers? John calls the study on Grace to You the Relationship Danger Zone. John, in spite of the clear command from Scripture that forbids Christians to marry non-Christians, there are a lot of believers who find themselves in that situation. Perhaps they become a Christian after the wedding. What do you tell people when they ask you what their options are biblically in terms of divorce and remarriage?
Well, there are always a lot of questions about marriage and divorce and so forth, and particularly in the situation where you have a believer with a non-believer. But the bottom line is, if you're married to a believer, stay married. If you're married to a non-believer, stay married. The New Testament instruction is to stay in the situation you are in.
The fact that you have become a believer is not grounds for divorce. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7 that the unbelieving spouse is sanctified by the believer. In other words, you are having a holy influence just because Christ is in you and Christ is in that relationship, therefore, and Christ is in that home in some way. So the Bible is clear that just being a Christian is not grounds to shed your unbelieving and perhaps unwanted spouse. Sure, you shift gears, you go into an evangelistic mode, and your goal is to honor your spouse and love your spouse in such a way as to make the work of Christ in your life winsome and attractive and to even draw them to salvation. There are a lot of questions regarding divorce and remarriage, and I've tried to answer them in a way that maybe will be helpful for you. I've put together a booklet with the simple title, Divorce and Remarriage. Obviously, I'm asked about these things all the time. So is our ministry. It's available free. Just ask for it, okay? Free booklet, Divorce and Remarriage. Just ask. We'll send it to you.
Is there ever a situation where the Bible permits divorce? Can a Christian remarry after getting divorced? This booklet answers these and many other important questions. Remember, we'll send you a free copy. Just ask for the booklet on divorce and remarriage as you contact us today. Call the toll-free number anytime, 24 hours a day, 1-800-55-GRACE. This booklet is free for the asking. Just ask for the divorce booklet when you call 800-55-GRACE. If you like, you can email a request to letters@gty.org or drop a note in the regular mail to Grace to You, Post Office Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412. When you get in contact, don't forget about John's current study, The Relationship Danger Zone. It's available on four CDs for $20. Order now by calling 1-800-55-GRACE. You can also purchase those CDs or download the individual lessons on MP3 for $3 each online at gty.org. Now let me say a word of thanks to you from John and the entire staff. Thank you for letting us know that you believe in what we're doing and that you support us through your prayers. Let us know how Grace to You is helping you learn and apply God's Word. Write to us today at Grace to You, Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412. Or send an email to letters@gty.org. And now for John MacArthur, thanks for setting aside this part of your Thursday to be with us. Do that again tomorrow, if you will, for another half hour of Unleashing God's Truth, one verse at a time, on the next Grace to You. You may have definite goals for your career and your health, but what goals should you set for your relationships? We'll consider the question tomorrow on the next Grace to You.